I want to speak this morning on the subject of Baptist origins and the Whitsitt controversy. This controversy raged within the Southern Baptist Convention from about 1886 to 1889, or to 99. William Whitsitt was a church history professor, came to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville in 1872. In 1895, he became the president of Southern, and then in 1899 was forced to resign. A firestorm fell on his head over his revolutionary view of Baptist history. The consensus among Baptists till about 1880, to the 1880s, 1890s, was that what we call Baptist perpetuity. That means that the Baptist views, doctrines, beliefs, have been in existence all through the ages in perpetuity from the days of Christ to the present. Well, Dr. Whitsitt is going to revolutionize that whole view. And we call this the 1641 theory. Sometimes it's called the English separatist dissent view. Well, the intellectual architect of that revolutionary view of Baptist history was Dr. William Whitsitt. His father had been a Tennessee Baptist preacher. But Whitsitt had gone to Europe and studied in the German seminaries under the higher criticism. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of evidence that he was affected by that doctrinally, but who knows? But anyhow, his view of Baptist history is going to be revolutionary. And he's going to hold this view and teach this view. In fact, he's going to say that he discovered this view. Now, there's a Congregationalist by the name of Henry Dexter, who claims to have discovered the same view, and I think that he was forced to become public. Dr. Whitsitt was forced to become public with this view in order to beat Dexter to the punch, but that's another story for another time. But Whitsitt first made his views known in 1880 in an independent congregational paper. And that paper had been known for its attack on the Baptists over the years. He wrote anonymously. Later on, it was discovered that Whitsitt had written these articles attacking the Baptist, what we call the doctrine of Baptist perpetuity, particularly with respect to the doctrine of immersion. He says that the Baptists invented, and that term galled the Baptists as well, that they invented immersion in 1641. That since the days of Henry VIII, the Baptists had sprinkled or poured. And this was contrary to every important Baptist history, every Baptist scholar that wrote Baptist history rejected that idea. And that always held to this view of what we call Baptist perpetuity all through the ages. But anyhow, Whitsitt was born in 1841, died in 1911. And here's some of the errors of his theory. Out of this 1641 theory comes this idea that Baptists are Protestants. Also, that Baptists were only about 400 years old. They came into existence around 1641, and that prior to that time, they did not immerse. They poured or sprinkled. And so this has come to be called the English separatist descent theory, that Baptists descended out of the English separatists. The English separatists were sometimes called Brownists. The father of English separatists was a man named Robert Brown. Robert Brown had led a movement that separated from the Church of England. Of course, the Church of England came out of the Catholic Church. So that's why, in the minds of some, that Baptists were Protestants, because they originated with the English separatists. And then some would say that Baptists are Protestants because of the rise of the particular Baptists in 1638 that came out of the independent Jesse Church, which is an English separatist church. But the fundamental error is just looking at some groups of Baptists, some minority of Baptists, and ignoring all the rest. That's at the root of so many historical problems. But here's some of the arguments. Whitsitt put forth what he called eight monuments or eight proofs that the Baptists invented immersion in 1641, he went on to say that the term Baptist, standing alone without the phrase Anabaptist in front of it, or the prefix "ana" in front of it, did not come into existence until 1644. And the historical evidence against Whitsitt is so overwhelming. It's almost like the evidence in the O.J. trial. The evidence is so strong and overwhelming that people just sort of, you know, they can't see the woods for the trees, I guess. But Here's some of the evidences that Whitsitt put forth. He quoted the Moravian Chronicle. Now, the origins of the Moravian Chronicle are very, very cloudy. We don't know where this Moravian Chronicle came from. But according to this Moravian Chronicle, supposedly written by Anabaptists, he claimed that the Anabaptists poured or sprinkled. Now, the Moravian Chronicle is a very, very questionable source. Scholarly historians have real difficulty with it. But, for example, in this Moravian Chronicle, it talks about baptism being the grace of God. Well, that sounds like the language of Paedobaptists. We Baptists don't talk about the grace of God in the ordinances. The ordinances do not convey the grace of God. They have no mystical powers. They have no saving efficacy. They don't wash away sin. They don't save your soul. They don't confirm salvation. So the whole Moravian Chronicle is a very, very questionable source. It was often quoted by Paedobaptists, so there's no real proof that it was even written by Anabaptists in the first place. But that was a source that had been used to prove that the Baptists supposedly had suspended immersion since the days of Henry VIII. And then there's some of the evidences against that, we know that some of those early Anabaptists certainly did immerse. A man named Conrad Grebel immersed a man named Wolfgang Uhlemann. And by the way, don't name your son Wolfgang. He'll get beat up a lot if you do that. But his name was Wolfgang Uhlemann, and he was immersed in the river. And he said that he did not want to be dipped out of a dish. Philip Schaff, the church historian, when you hear that name, that's a very, very important name. He's considered perhaps the premier church historian. He was a Presbyterian, but he wrote with absolute integrity. And he says that the Anabaptists immersed. And if Schaff said that they immersed, they probably were immersed. He writes with such integrity and with such research and such honesty. But another important proof that the Anabaptists immersed was Zwingli. Zwingli says, well, if these Anabaptists want to, he called them drowners. When they immerse, they drown each other. And he called them drowners. He was very arrogant, very cruel, very mean and tyrannical. And his attitude towards these Anabaptists was a very, very vicious, mean, arrogant spirit. He said, well, if these Anabaptists want to be drowned, let's give them a third drowning. They want to be immersed, let's immerse them a third time. And what he meant by that, if they refused to have their infants baptized and preach against infant baptism, they would be given the death penalty. And the mode of capital punishment was to be drowned. Brother Cummings mentioned about Felix Mons. He refused to have his infant baptized. He preached against infant baptism. They arrested Mons. They tied his wrists together, tied his ankles together, and they slipped his arms over his knees and put a stick under his knees, put him in a rowboat, and rowed him out into the middle of the Lamotte River there in Zurich and pushed him overboard and drowned him. That was a third baptism, if you count infant baptism. He supposedly was baptized as an infant, and when he got saved and born again, he really got baptized. And then Zwingli conducted a third baptism, executed him by drowning. That's a proof. That's evidence that those Anabaptists immersed. If Zwingli called them drowners, he was referring to their mode of baptism. So there's some very strong evidences against the Moravian Chronicle and against the evidences of Whitsitt. Probably the most important source for Whitsitt was a set of records called the Jesse Church Records. And a part of those records, as I understand it, was what they call the Kiffin Manuscript. And as far as we know, this is the only evidence that Whitsitt claimed for actually proving that the Baptists invented, quote-unquote, immersion after 1641. In these very debatable records, most historians think they're very fraudulent. John Christian traveled across the Atlantic. Studied these documents firsthand and came to the conclusion that they were forgeries. They were full of errors and all kinds of difficult problems. But actually, as far as documentary evidence, this is the only proof that Whitsitt had, that immersion was invented after 1641. And in these documents, it talks about a man named that the Baptists, when they began, the particular Baptist who's being made reference to, that they were debating about immersion. And that nobody was supposedly qualified. They came to the conviction that they ought to immerse, But nobody had been immersed, therefore nobody was qualified to baptize anyone, to immerse them. So they sent a man named Richard Blount over to Holland, and then over to Holland he was baptized, and he came back to England and began to baptize others. And that's the beginning of immersion among the Baptists in England. But the problem is that this Gould Kiffin manuscript that Christian study was contrary to the Kiffin manuscript of Thomas Crosby, the first Baptist historian. So there are all kinds of contradictions, all kinds of errors. It's a very, very very questionable source of authority. But that's the whole foundation in many ways of Whitsitt's theory. But he gave what he called eight evidences. Quickly, here's some of the evidences, some other evidence that he gave. He said immersion was not mentioned in any Baptist confession of faith until the particular Baptist confession of 1644. Remember, this 1644 confession was drawn from the London Confession, which was based on the Westminster Confession of the Presbyterians. And this is very much of an argument from science. We know that in the history of England, everybody immersed. All the English monarchs were immersed. Queen Elizabeth was immersed. Edward before her was immersed. The first English king to be sprinkled was King James VI of Scotland, who was a Presbyterian. Then he moved down to, upon the death of Elizabeth in 1603, became James I of England. And there's going to be these Presbyterians, the Scottish, that introduced sprinkling into England around the time that King James I became King of England. And we know that he was sprinkled. He had been a Presbyterian, and now he'll become an Anglican when he becomes the King of England, King James I. And but the idea is that about this time they'll draw up a confession of faith. In 1644 there'll be a great debate in Parliament. The Presbyterians will get control of the Parliament, and they're going to be given the order by the Parliament to draw up a statement of faith by which they may impose Presbyterianism on England as the state church. And so they're ordered to draw up a statement of faith. We call that the Westminster Assembly, the Westminster Confession today. And those Puritans, Presbyterians in Parliament are called the Westminster Divines. And they came to a debate in the Parliament over whether or not to sprinkle or immerse. And this debate went on, and there was a tie, 24-24. Half of the Presbyterians believed that you should vote for immersion. The other half voted for sprinkling. And the tie was broken by one man. By one vote, they decided that sprinkling would be the law. And so they brought the force of Parliament behind that legislation that required sprinkling. Well, about that time, shortly after that time, the Baptists drew up their confession of faith in 1644. And so the argument by Whitsitt is that, well, why would the Baptists must have just discovered immersion because that's the first time they put it in a statement of faith in 1644. Well, if it's never been an issue, well, why would you even bring it up and put it in a confession of faith? Everybody immersed. The English monarchs were all immersed. The Catholics immersed. Everybody immersed. So why would you make a point of something that wasn't even at question? It's like reminding somebody to, well, you need to be sure and breathe this morning while you're here in the services. Why bring those things up? Those things were assumed and so on. But that's one of his arguments. Daniel Neal, in his History of the Puritans, written in 1743, said that the Baptists had always immersed. Daniel Neal was not a Baptist. He ignored much of the evidence, but he suggested that the Baptists had always immersed. One of the great scholars of that day was a man named David Masson, who wrote a Life of John Milton. And David Masson was in the British Museum. He said that he read every document that pertained to this question between 1640 and 43. And he was surprised to find out that anybody ever questioned the fact that the Baptists immersed. So these scholars, Daniel Neal, Thomas Crosby, the old Baptist historian, says that the Baptists immersed all the way up to his time period. And he wrote his first great Baptist history in 1738. Philip Schaff said that everybody practiced immersion, that immersion was the common mode of baptism up to the middle of the 17th century. Well, that's a little bit past 1641, is it not, if I understand my chronology correctly? So the evidence by these scholars is that the Baptists have always immersed. One of the great enemies of the Baptists was a man named Daniel Featley. And he had a great debate over with William Kiffin, one of the old Baptists there in England. And they had the famous Featley-Kiffin debate. And Featley wrote a book called The Dipper's Dipped about 1544. And he said that he observed for 20 years previously the Baptists out in the river dipping each other. Of course, now he was writing in contempt of them. But in 1644, he says, for the previous 20 years, I've observed these Baptists out here dipping each other in the river. So the evidence is so overwhelming, you wonder why it would even be a debated question. Some of the other arguments that Whitsitt had against the Baptists, as far as the perpetuity of their immersion, their mode. In 1644, he said that the term Baptist itself did not come into existence until 1644. So there's no evidence that everybody ever used the term Baptist without the prefix Anna prior to 1644. Well, John Christian, who researched this carefully, said that the term Baptist had been used from the earliest days of the Reformation. Now, quite frankly, we don't really know for sure the first time that it was used without the prefix Anna. Some think it may have begun in Wales. But we know that Lord Burley, William Cecil, the chief advisor to Queen Elizabeth in 1569, was writing about these Baptists. And of course, he was concerned about their influence, and he wanted to put a stop to them and so on. But William Cecil, Lord Burley, in 1569, used the term Baptist without the prefix Anna in front of it. Whitsitt is clearly wrong, clearly unhistorical. Some other arguments that he used, that there was no controversy over baptism until Edward Barber's a little booklet called A Small Treatise on Baptism or Dipping in 1642. Whitsitt takes the position that nobody wrote any pamphlets or books or essays defending immersion prior to 1642. Thomas Angus identified something like 26 pamphlets that were written prior to 1642 discussing immersion, defending immersion. We know that in the Jesse Church had a number of splits. They split in 1633, 1638, had another split in 1640. And every time they split, Baptist churches were being created out of this independent church, this English separatist church called the Jesse Church. And a part of that debate was over infant baptism, but also immersion was an issue. And so William Kiffin split from that church in 1640, the Jesse Church. And one of the reasons he split from the Jesse Church because he would not affiliate in the pulpit, would not believe in non-affiliation with a man that was not immersed. He was saying, I will not be on the same platform. I will not preach with a non-immersed man. And this was the issue in 1640. So the evidence is so overwhelming that the immersion was indeed an issue. It split church, split this church, perhaps others, long before 1644. Some other arguments. He says that no one wrote a book in England prior to Barber defending immersion alone is the only proper mode. In 1614, a man named Mark Leonard Busher, wrote a book called Religion's Peace. And there's debate whether he was in London or whether he was in Holland at the time, but we know that book circulated all over England in the early 17th century. The book was written in 1614. In that book, Leonard Busher talked about baptism as dipping those dead in the water, to be dipped dead in the water. That sounds a lot like immersion, does it not? Some other important books, John Norcott. Spurgeon was so impressed with his defense of immersion that he had that reproduced for his own people. But John Norcott, who was associated with John Smith, the founder of the General Baptist, he wrote a great book defending immersion. To Zion's Virgin, 1634-37, defended immersion. The Sum of Holy Scripture by Simon Fish was first published in 1529, republished again in 1547 and 48, 1550. It was called the Baptist Book. And in that book, obviously defended the mode of immersion. Another argument was that there was no church division over immersion prior to 1641. We've already talked about the divisions in the Jesse Church. And he said another argument was that the General Baptists wanted to unite with the Mennonites. And there was negotiations going on that among some of the General Baptists to unite with the Mennonites. And those negotiations broke down after the Baptists began to immerse because the Mennonites sprinkled. Well, some Mennonites did come to sprinkling, but Menno Simmons himself was immersed, and he immersed others, the father of the Mennonites. But anyhow, What he's doing, again, making that fundamental error that's so often made. He's looking at one small group of General Baptists, one small group of Baptists who were attempting to merge with the Mennonites. Not all Baptists wanted to merge with the Mennonites. He's neglecting all these others. But again, so many of these are arguments from silence. There's no proof, no strong evidence that those negotiations broke down over the issue of immersion. He just assumed that, like he does so many other things. Another argument that Whitsitt has that there was an alarm over the health implications of immersion. Now, this was the argument that Richard Baxter brought against the Baptists. He said that immersion can be very harmful to your health. Well, all the English monarchs never seemed to worry about it over the centuries. The Baptists never seemed to worry about it. Richard Baxter had great hatred and contempt for the Baptists. He was kind of a gadfly, sort of a cantankerous. He was very cantankerous and was always quarreling and debating and fussing and fighting about everything. One observer of Richard Baxter says that Richard would debate Baxter and Baxter would debate Richard. He was such a quarrelsome, cantankerous individual that he didn't really seem to have much credibility. Well, in this case, he seemed to have had no credibility at all. But he said, this thing may be causing health problems, people getting immersed. And that was his end. So, but again, this was what, but Whitsitt took this criticism of Richard Baxter and used that as an argument, another argument in his defense that baptism was not invented until 1641. Philip Schaff said that immersion was the common mode in England to the middle of the 17th century. Then Whitsitt's last argument was that the word rantize came into existence after 1641. Well, since these Baptists began to immerse after 1641, they had to find a new word. And so they began to use the Greek word rantezo, which means to sprinkle. Again, these are, and so you had, since immersion came along, now you had different forms of baptism, are different modes, so now you have to have another word to describe a different kind of baptism. And again, this is another argument from silence. These are some of the arguments of Dr. Whitsitt. But we say he's the father of the English separatist theory of Baptist origins. Now, one of his arguments, one of the arguments is this, that these English separatists had great influence on the Baptists, and the Baptists came out of these English separatists. Some historians say it's just the opposite, that the Dutch Anabaptists were actually responsible for leading people to come to a separatist position. That these men in the Church of England began to be influenced by the Dutch Anabaptists. As a result of the influence of these Dutch Anabaptists, there was the creation of an English separatist movement. So they reversed the procedure. Rather than the English separatists influencing the Baptists, the argument is that the Dutch Anabaptists influenced those within the Church of England to become separatists. One of the most important historians who took this position was a man named William Williston Walker, who was a professor at Yale, and in his day the leading authority in church history, perhaps in America, back around the early turn of the century, and he was a Congregationalist. But listen to what Williston Walker said about the influence of the Dutch Anabaptists on Robert Brown. Robert Brown now is considered to be the father of English separatism. The English separatists became, for example, the Pilgrims that came to America would be English separatists. They were called in England independents, called Congregationalists, many of those that separated from the Church of England. But listen to what Williston Walker says. He stated this. He says, in their abandonment of the state church, he's talking about the English separatists, in their abandonment of the state church, Church of England, in their direct appeal to the Word of God for every detail of administration, in their organization and officers, their likeness of those of the radical reformers, the Anabaptists, those Dutch Anabaptists in Norwich, those radical reformers on the continent is so striking that some affiliation seems almost certain. A denial of relationship exceedingly difficult. The similarity of the system, Brown's separatism and the Dutch Anabaptists, which he now worked out from that of the Anabaptists, is so great in many respects that the conclusion is hard to avoid that the resemblance is more than accidental. Now, what Walker is saying, in about 1580, Robert Brown moved to Norwich. Norwich is in East Anglia. Now, that became a hotbed of the Dutch Anabaptists. When they fled persecution from across on the continent, they came across the Channel, the North Sea, and they settled in and around Norwich. And we know there's a great body of those Dutch Anabaptists. Their ideas were circulating all over England, these Baptist ideas, by the 1530s. Brown moves there in 1580. And there's some debate exactly when he started his separatist church, 1581 or 84. There's some debate about that year. But what Wilson Walker is saying, he said that his church, in effect, bears so many marks of these Dutch Anabaptists that he must have had tremendous influence on it. That's the point that Walker is making. Now, in those days, the Dutch Anabaptists were the offscouring of the world. You would never want to give credit to those people for influencing you. So Robert Brown would never have given credit to have been influenced by this bed of snakes. They were called a bed of snakes. They were called all kinds of names, pejorative terms. And so you wouldn't, if you bought one of these ideas, you wouldn't certainly want to give them credit for it. But in sum, the argument is this, that probably the evidence seems pretty powerful, pretty persuasive, that the English separatists was not the source of the Baptists. But the influence of the Dutch Anabaptists probably created the English separatist movement. Probably the other way around. There's a book out, I haven't seen it in recent years, but probably out of print, by a Southern Baptist by the name of Morgan Patterson. If you can get a hold of this book, you ought to get it. But it's called Baptist Successionism. And it's supposed to be a refutation of Baptist perpetuity, of the things we've been talking about. It's supposed to be a defense of Whitsitt's views, of his English separatist descent theory, or the 1641 theory. And in this book, he says these old Baptist historians like Armitage and John Christian and G.H. Orchard and J.M. Carroll and David Benedict, he said they were careless scholars. They were unscholarly. They relied so heavily on secondary sources. In other words, they violated so many of the canons of historical scholarship. Well, they should just be discredited. Now, if you want to see a book that has a great deal of careless, unscholarly work, read Morgan Patterson's book, Baptist Successionism. It's amazing how wrong he is on things, how he gets these facts wrong. See, when you're a fundamentalist, you've got to dot every I, cross every T, you've got to have it just right. If you're a new evangelical or a liberal, they don't care how intellectually sloppy you are. Charles Colson wrote a book some years ago. They counted something like 60-some, 70, 80, 90 errors in the thing, attacking an independent Baptist. Well, this independent Baptist took Colson to court, and the judge defended the Baptist and said that Colson indeed was wrong. But Colson had, it was unbelievable how many errors of fact he had in his attack on this Baptist. And they asked him on the witness stand, well, how come you didn't get in contact with this man and get your facts straight? He said, well, I thought he was dead. The other day, Chuck Colson, he still writes for Christianity Today and has all kinds of credibility. Well, if that had been a fundamentalist, they'd have written him off. But if you're a new evangelical, you can be intellectually sloppy, you can be mean, you can be vindictive. You just, for some reason, you don't lose your credibility. So it's very important now that we dot all of our I's and cross all of our T's and make sure we're accurate. We do our homework. But anyhow, listen to some of these great scholars, just quickly. David Benedict wrote a general history of the Baptists. He died in 1874. He wrote seven major works. Of course, we know of his history of the Baptists. His history of the Donatists, he wrote at the end of his life. He spent the last 10 years of his life writing a little book called The History of the Donatists. It's a little masterpiece. You ought to own that. Benedict traveled across the Atlantic Ocean, went to North Africa, and studied in the original Latin documents by Optatus and Augustine himself and the Donatists. He did original research in these documents. This book came out in 1874. He traveled over 4,000 miles on horseback all over America collecting materials for his history. He believed in working out the original materials. Morgan Patterson said, well, they just relied very heavily on secondary materials. Well, that's just plain, let's just say, it's more charitable to say a man's ignorant than he is dishonest. Let's just say he was ignorant. Benedict worked very much out of the original material. Traveled 4,000 miles visiting churches, archives, everywhere he'd go to find diaries and letters and church records. that he examined records of more than 2,000 churches, wrote hundreds of letters and so on in search for factual material. He studied the classics. He was a graduate of Brown University. He knew Isaac Backus personally and inherited a lot of the historical materials from Isaac Backus. Another important historian was Thomas Armitage. Armitage died in 1896. I think this is the greatest of all the Baptist histories, by the way. John Christian's is a great work, too. Armitage is a little more detailed. But all these old Baptist historians rejected what we call physical chain link succession. None of these men, if you read their works very carefully, held to this idea that there's a succession of baptisms all the way back to John the Baptist. Now, that's not historical. That's not biblical. And we're not contending for that. We're not contending for any kind of physical chain link succession of baptisms that goes all the way back to John the Baptist. We're not contending for physical chain link church succession. You know, if we can't prove our church came out of this church that was started by this church that goes all the way back to the First Baptist Church of Jerusalem, you're not in the valid line of churches. No one contends for that, or at least no real historian, and certainly the Word of God doesn't demand that. All we're contending for is that somewhere, sometime, all through history, there's been people who've held to these precious doctrines that we call the Baptist distinctives today. They've never died out. That's all that we're... It's a succession of belief. Some call it a succession of suffering. It's a succession of doctrine. It's not a physical chain link of ordinations. Apostolic succession. You know, if you can't trace your pastor's ordination to all the way back to when the Lord Jesus Christ or when John was... when Peter was ordained or whatever. Now, we're not contending for baptismal succession, ordinational succession, apostolic succession, church succession. All we're contending for that someone... Sometimes, in all times, everywhere, somewhere at least, there's always been Bible-believing people that would hold to the Baptist distinctives. That's all that we're contending for. If you read these old church historians carefully, that's all that they're contending for. John Christian, he died in 1926. He has also his two-volume work, which is a tremendous work, full of those great old original documents. The book is very valuable, but for those documents alone that he records. His book, by the way, used to be the standard in the Southern Baptist seminaries. And then after the result of Whitsitt's influence and later on, they began to go to other Protestant views of the history of the Baptist. Christian had been a pastor in Mississippi, been a church history professor in New Orleans Institute and a librarian. Had a personal library of 15,000 volumes. He made 7 trips to Europe for research and books and did postgraduate work. Christian was a member, had membership in these organizations: the Society of Christian Archaeology of Greece, the Academy of History of France, the Academy of Science, the American Society of History. All these men rejected this chain-link succession. All that we call for, all we contend for, is a succession of belief. J.M. Carroll died in 1931, the brother of B.H. Carroll, and he wrote probably the most published Baptist history of all called The Trail of Blood. If you go back and read that carefully, that's actually a very scholarly little book. And if you read it very, very carefully, he is not contending for church successionism or Baptist successionism or ordinational successionism. He's just saying, he uses the word succession, but if you read it carefully, he's really talking about doctrinal succession, a succession of belief. But he wrote a history of the Texas Baptists. He wrote The Trail of Blood when he was 70 years old. After years of research in different places, collected one of the greatest libraries in America. But again, a man that researched other original materials. G.H. Orchard, he was introduced to America by the landmarkers, J.R. Graves. And he's often considered probably perhaps the best example of this, some kind of physical chain link succession. But again, if you read the G.H. Orchard's works carefully, you see a beautiful, powerful prose. You see a tremendous mind. These men were tremendous scholars. By the way, they're all sound in doctrine. They were saved, born again, regenerate men. I think that makes a lot of difference how you approach your history, don't you? But he labored 15 years on his work. He studied for 30 years in the libraries and museums of London. All these great old Baptist historians were men who were true scholars. They saw history, the literary life, as a calling. And they made a wonderful, wonderful contribution. Well, the evidence of this, what we call Baptist perpetuity, I think is overwhelming. And the great scholars, the great historians, it was almost unanimous until the late 1900s that the Baptists have always existed, sometime, somewhere, under some name, where we've held to these great distinctives, this cluster of New Testament ideas that we call the Baptist distinctives. Lord bless you.